This is Whitley Strieber, and you have made a courageous choice. You're listening to Dreamland, a truly free, non-commercial voice on the internet. And from 22,500 miles in the sky on 1.FM and the Global Star Communications Radio Network, we say it like it is. We take you where others will not take you. Dreamland, welcome to the edge of the world.
From Nashville, this is William Henry filling in for Whitley Strieber. This is Dreamland. Welcome, everyone. Stargate 2012 is my term for a vision that connects humans intimately with our galaxy. It's a Milky Way-based vision based on the notion that our galaxy is the great cosmic mother of myth and legend. She is Isis. She is Mary. She is the mother who gives birth to the sun and to the mysterious light that sustains us. From the perspective of the galactic center, there is no difference between God and Allah, Jesus, and Muhammad. Metaphorically, the universe is the great mother hen. Our galaxy is a golden, glowing cosmic egg among hundreds of billions of other glowing cosmic eggs. Our planet is an embryo in this incredible cosmic being. From the galaxy's nucleus comes a cosmic substance the Mayans called sap, and a godlike force they called eats. This force is transforming the previously incubating Homo sapien into what Terence McKenna calls galaxy-roving bodhisattvas, what the Incas call Homo luminous, and what I call starwalkers. So imagine a race of illumined beings that suddenly manifests on our planet and transforms it, connecting it to a higher consciousness. This prophecy is unfolding right now. We are that race of illumined beings. And today we are joined by author and filmmaker Jay Widener, who is here to tell us more about our path, our hatching, and the emergence of Homo luminous. Jay's built a repository of knowledge into his works, which include the incredible book The Cross of Hende, the DVD Secrets of Alchemy, a Dreamland favorite, and now 2012, The Odyssey with Sharon Rose. The metaphor of bridge building comes to mind. Jay is a bridge builder connecting us to the mind of the alchemist, the ancient spiritual scientist who watched nature and who understood her secrets of the holistic nature of our existence. Jay will help us understand the end time, 2012, and the secrets of nature and of time itself. Jay, welcome to Dreamland.
Hey, it's great to be here, William.
It's a true pleasure to have you back on the show, Jay. You've recognized for a very long time that as 2012 approaches, many of the ancient secrets would have to be revealed. And in fact, the core insights surrounding 2012, the end date of the Mayan calendar, a rare alignment with the center of the galaxy that happens only once in every 26,000 years, and a double catastrophe, all three of these core components can be traced to the work done in the mid-1990s in Boulder, Colorado by you and John Major Jenkins. Let's begin there, Jay, with a kind of an understanding of what this whole business of 2012 is really all about.
Well, that's a great question, and I have to say that this whole entire work has been replete with synchronicity after synchronicity, and one of the most joyous synchronicities of all was the fact that John Major Jenkins and I were living about 17 miles apart, and we didn't even know it. And we were both working on different aspects of this galactic paradigm that's about to emerge. Jenkins coming from the Mayan point of view, and of course I coming from the alchemical point of view in Europe. And so there does seem to be a kind of a strange manipulation of forces here on Earth by what I call the Overmind. And the Overmind is a kind of a hyperdimensional sphere that exists around the Earth. Teilhard de Chardin called it the noosphere, and it is directing this thing. And I know that sounds incredible, but every day I'm more and more convinced that we are being directed towards a destiny that is, you know, it cannot be argued with anymore. And your work and a lot of other people's work, Jose Arguelles and a lot of other people, have really come together now here at the end of this age. And through the internet and radio shows like this, we're able to actually, for the first time, compare notes across different streams of knowledge. And we're finding that, whoa, you know, we're we're all talking about the same thing. We're using different terminology. We're using different languages. We're in different cultures, but we're all talking about the same thing. And what we're talking about is that this age, the great fourth age, is about to end and the fifth sun is dawning. And what this means for us as a people is anybody's guess, but I think, you know, you can't feel anything but optimistic about the way things are going, the incredible plethora of knowledge that's emerging now at the end of time, and the fact that it's getting harder and harder to BS us as a people. The politicians are pulling their hair out. The scientists and scholars don't know what to do because we're all waking up, and we're waking up very, very quickly.
And there's such tremendous power in that awakening, too. And in your new DVD, 2012, The Odyssey, you bring together a chorus of very important voices, including Terrence McKenna, Greg Braden, Moira Timms, Jose Arguelles, Alberto Villado, Jeff Strait, of course, John Major Jenkins. But playing the role of the every person in 2012 is someone who I know is very special to you. That would be Sharon Rose. Tell us about Sharon, Jay, and her role in this project.
Well, it was about a year and a half ago. Sharon, we were trying to decide what our next film project would be, and Sharon was interested in making a film, but we weren't sure. We had it down to three or four different subjects, and we were another strange synchronicity. We were walking along the beach in Seattle, and I had Jeff Stray just sent me his new book, at that time new, Beyond 2012, which is a book I highly recommend to everyone. And we were walking along, and I was going to stop at the beach, you know, and read. It was a nice sunny day. And a guy in his 40s was riding by on his bicycle, and he slammed on his brakes suddenly right next to us on the sidewalk near the beach. And he looked down at the book I had, and he said, "What's that book?" And I said, "Oh, this is a new book about 2012. And he said, "I've always been really fascinated with 2012. And he jumped on his bike and he rode away. And Sharon and I are kind of just staring at each other going, "Huh? Like, what was that?" Right? And why did he stop? And how did he see the book? And how did he, you know, what caused him to even ask? And we never saw the guy again. But in that moment, Sharon decided that she was going to make a film about 2012. And she went around the country and contacted everyone who were experts. We tried to get William Henry, but we couldn't seem to hook up, and we made the film, and it's now coming out here in, you know, this time, and Sharon did a great job, I think, in asking the question and getting the people to really, really unload as to what they thought would happen. So, you know, I think she just did a great job. I think she's the perfect narrator because she doesn't have an axe to grind or anything. You know, she isn't selling books about 2012 or anything, and she doesn't have a point of view about 2012. So I think she was, in some ways, the perfect narrator, kind of a candide, roaming the landscape, asking the questions of scholars and philosophers like the people that you mentioned. And she did a great job, I think.
Right. Sharon Rose is a filmmaker, teacher, writer, choreographer, and Fulbright Senior Research Scholar in World Mythology and Religion and Sacred Arts of Dance, Music, and Theater. In addition to 2012 The Odyssey, she's the author of the award-winning book The Path of the Priestess, a guidebook for awakening the divine feminine, published by Inner Traditions, a Dreamland favorite publisher. She's also creator of the DVD Yoga of Light and producer of the Sacred Mysteries DVD collection. So you're right. She brings a very powerful perspective to this whole story and a very, not just an open mind, but also an open heart to the presentation that just kind of brings us along in a very nice way. Jay, there's some incredible voices that we hear from in this presentation. To begin with, I think we have to start with Jose Arguelles, who many will recall brought forward this whole idea of the harmonic convergence back in 1987 and has been ever since then attempting to bring light to the whole issue or the research surrounding the Mayan calendar. In the DVD, he says that the difference between the Maya and the global civilization of today is that we are very happy when a synchronicity happens to us every so often, whereas the Maya, living on the Maya calendar, synchronicity is the norm. And
that's
I have a
right,
sense that
yeah.
you would agree with something like that.
Well, it is. I think people who are attuned to what's happening are having so many synchronicities happen to them that they're beginning to think that it's the norm. I know that's the case in my life. And we're always surprised when we talk to someone and they don't recognize the synchronicities. But just because you don't recognize a synchronicity doesn't mean it's not happening. And 90% of the synchronicity is realizing that it's a synchronicity and then acting on it. So I think awareness and consciousness dovetail with synchronicities. And I think that after 2012, all of time and all of the events that are, will occur will all be synchronous. And I think at that point, we're going to function as a unit. And Jose, you know, he's just, what can I say, he's just one of my favorite people. I was high for a week after we did our interview with him, because he just, we went on for another 2 hours with you know, other stuff that he was talking about, which was, you know, just so cogent. And he really is, I think, you know, the godfather of the movement. And it wouldn't have been complete without him. And I think he just, you know, he really brought a perspective, a kind of a Latin perspective that maybe we in the United States don't have. And what's great about Jose, though, is that he was, you know, he's a scholar and he was educated in the United States. And so he's this great kind of combination of this Latin, Mayan perspective coupled with a fierce scholarly approach that the West gives to people who are educated in their schools. And Jose is, you know, just fabulous. And he just sent us an email. He really, really, really liked the film and said that he thinks it's going to do for 2012 what An Inconvenient Truth is doing for global warming. I think that's a great compliment, and I hope that it's true. And, you know, I think he's just a great guy. And I think that that as we approach 2012, Jose is going to pull a couple rabbits out of the hat that are going to be really amazing. And I think we should all sit on the edge of our seats waiting for what Jose is going to do next. I think it's going to be very, very important.
Well, likewise, Jay, we're all waiting to see what you're going to do next, too, because you've for a long time been kind of our guide as we go down this rabbit hole here. When we get back from the break, Jay, I want to talk about what it means to be in the zone of galactic alignment. This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We'll be right back.
The end of this age is at hand. Everything around us, everything that we know is about to change. And this change is going to be radical, like nothing that we've ever experienced before. But as in all times of great change, this shift offers us an opportunity to look deep within ourselves and think about who we are, the way we relate to the earth, and to the people around us.
Thus begins Jay Widener's extraordinary new DVD, a film by Sharon Rose. Don't miss it. Get it from the unknowncountry.com store. Click on the store tab now. Get Jay's new DVD. It is beautiful, magnificently produced, truly marvelous work. And the music is unforgettable as well.
Hi, my name is Al Harlow, and I run the unknowncountry.com store and the subscriber section. So when you buy from us, you buy from me, personally. And I think I run a very special store. Whitley and Ann Strieber have read every single book in it, and they know most of the authors personally. And that's why when I say it is, very simply, the best bookstore of its kind in the world, I can stand behind those words. And I stand behind my store, too. When you buy here, you buy from me. When you have a question or a problem, you don't get some nameless autoresponder with a canned answer. You get me. And I get you your answer. So click on that store tab right now and explore. Your mind will thank you.
This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We're continuing with Jay Widener, author and filmmaker, discussing his incredible DVD, 2012, The Odyssey. Jay, just before the break, I brought up a topic that is so vital to really getting a handle on this whole issue, this whole idea of 2012. And that stems from this idea expressed by John Major Jenkins in the DVD that we are in the zone of galactic alignment right now. What does that mean?
Well, that's a great question. Every 26,000 years, as the Earth wobbles in its course during the precession of the equinoxes, we line up on the winter solstice with the center of the galaxy. And that's about to happen on December 21st, 2012, which is the whole crux of the Mayan prophecy. What's interesting about this, by the way, is that the exact universal time that the alignment happens is 11:11 in the morning. So Jenkins did this kind of incredible work that he kind of finished off in his book Galactic Alignment. And what it means is that, in my view anyway, is that one thing you have to understand is that our solar system sits in the very center of the ecliptic of the galactic of the galaxy. And this might be a coincidence, I don't know. About 75% of the matter in the galaxy lies in the ecliptic, so it's really not that incredible, but it is important. And a great book by Wilhelm Reich called Cosmic Superimposition, and he talks about how there's these pulsating waves that are coming from the center of the galaxy, riding along the edge of the ecliptic. And when we go to at 90 degrees to this wave, it hits us. And that's what has been happening since about 1992 and will culminate in 2012. And it's sort of, I use the analogy of like a ship turning into the current. So suddenly the ship is riding with the current as opposed to against the current, or it's sideways to the current. And when that happens, everything just becomes easier. The engines don't have to work as hard. Everything just becomes easier. And I think that we're making this gigantic turn, so to speak, into the galactic current. And it's happening right now as we speak. And this is really what alchemy is about. And it's what most of the indigenous traditions are talking about. And as we emerged out of this galactic current 13,000 years ago, we fell into matter and we fell into ignorance. And I think that's what is disappearing right now. And we're now emerging out of a long, long period where we really didn't understand what was going on. We really didn't have an idea of who we were. And I think now, as we're approaching this end point, it's all beginning to shift and change. Everything is beginning to emerge. All the secrets are being released. We're realizing that human beings are really, really special. And the universe has thrown the dice with us. And they're betting it. The universe is betting its future on us. And it's up to us to make sure we don't blow it. And this galactic alignment is, you know, the seminal event that's happening. And it's just so important. The Cross of Hende is talking about it. The Incans talk about it. The entire Sacred Valley in Cusco is really a creation of the galaxy on the ground. We know that the Egyptians, Schwaller de Lubitsch says that the Egyptians reworked the Nile River so that it flowed into the Mediterranean, that it should flow into the Red Sea, but instead it flows into the Mediterranean. And they built this as a symbolic representation of the galaxy on the ground, and then they built the pyramids and their monuments around this. So, you know, this is the religion of the past, and we are moving from a solar religion, which is what Christianity and Judaism and Islam and many others, to a galactic religion, and that's what's emerging right now. And so we're going to move from solar time to lunar time. We're going to move from realizing that the sun is not the center of creation, that it's the center of the galaxy, that the sun is the sun of the center of the galaxy, which is, as you said, Isis. And even that is emerging now after centuries and centuries of ignorance about what Isis was. We're now beginning to realize that the descriptions that the Egyptians gave us of Isis fit exactly perfectly with our description of the center of the galaxy. We can't see her. We can't see the center of the galaxy. She gave birth to all of the stars and suns. and the center of the galaxy gave birth to all the stars and suns. And she is the center of creation, and the center of the galaxy is the center of creation in our local cosmic neighborhood. And so all of this is happening right now. It's emerging even as we speak, and Jenkins and his work is just seminal, just scholarly and seminal to this entire understanding. And it's just, you know, one of my great fortunate joys in my life that he and I became friends, lived next to each other for a long time, and were able to compare notes and really create a synthesis of ideas that is emerging in his work now and is emerging in my work. So it's a great partnership, and, I just can't appreciate my friendship with Jenkins enough.
Another voice, Jay, in 2012, The Odyssey, is, of course, Greg Braden, who states that for over 5,000 years, since 3000 B.C., the year when José Arguelles proposes, well, approximately, anyway, 3100 B.C., says is when Earth entered a beam of intelligently moderated energy from the galactic center. That's year zero of the Kali Yuga. Krishna was believed to have been born around 3100 B.C. The Mayan calendar that ends in December 2012 began in 3114 B.C. It's the civilization of Egypt, the first pharaoh, the first dynasty, was around 3100 B.C. It seems, and as Greg points out, that our spiritual traditions have used that as an anchor point, and spiritual teachers have ever since been preparing us for 2012.
Oh, boy, that is for sure. There's so many incredible things that happened around 3100 B.C., including actual writing, the spreading of time, for instance, the 24-hour clock, the 60-minute hour. All these things emerged around this time. The first walled cities of Catalhoyuk appeared around this time, Mesopotamia. All of this stuff is appearing around this time period, and, you know, it is just, you know, a remarkable coincidence, I guess, if you're logically and rationally oriented, to say that, you know, the Mayans picked this time period as the beginning of the final age. Greg is an old friend of mine. I knew Greg before he was even famous or anything. He was still working as a geologist. And,
wow.
I'm actually the first person to, made Greg's very first video about 15 years ago, and got him his first gig in Seattle, his first lecture gig. And Greg and I have just been friends for a long, long time. And again, another strange synchronicity. I had not seen Greg in 8 years, and I went to a lecture by Jonathan Goldman at a bookstore in Seattle, and there was Greg Braden. And we hadn't seen each other in a long time, and the lecture was going on. I was trying to figure out, you know, what the message was. Why would Greg show up right now? And then I realized that he had to be in the 2012 film. So after the lecture, I asked Greg if he would appear in it, and he said, yeah. And I said, so where are you living? And he told me his address, and he was living 3 blocks away from me. incredible. We've been living next 3 blocks away from each other for almost 2 years, and we didn't even know it. And so 2 or 3 days later, we met in a park nearby, and we shot the interview, and Greg was great, and he really brings the heart, I think, to this work, and shows us that it's through individual acts every day that we will do what we're about to do. And he talks about, you know, kindness and compassion, and how this is really a hard thing for us to do these days in a world that is, you know, seems to be descending into darkness. And that is how we're going to pull ourselves out. It's the individual acts that we do every day, helping people out, helping your neighbors, you know, letting someone who's in a hurry get ahead of you in line. All these little acts. And I think that's what Greg brought to the video and to the film. And, he's just such a great guy. And he's an old friend, and I guess it was the ultimate payback for all the help that I gave him years ago. And, to me, I just think he did a great job. And he's right. The spiritual voices that have been existing throughout the last 5,000 years haven't been designed so much to create a moment of enlightenment in that time period. They were like messages in a bottle sent downstream through time so that at this point in time, we could read what they said and we could understand what they said, and that would help us navigate the very treacherous waters that we're in right now. And we are in treacherous waters. And Greg, of course, also brings in, as a geologist, he brings in his entire knowledge about the reversal of the magnetic field. And then this is a very real thing that's going on. This can be registered and this can be monitored through geology. And this is happening. The magnetic field is dropping. It hasn't been like this for 50, 100,000 years, and it's dropping right now. And the poles may shift at this point. There's great work by a guy named Hans Jenny, who did a work on, called Cymatics. And in the cymatics, he shows that as you change the frequency of sound, you can actually change the structure of matter. And that's what's going on now. The frequency of the Earth is being altered. And as the frequency of the Earth is altered, so too is the molecular structure of organisms on the Earth being altered. And that is what's happening to us. We're literally being reconfigured. We're literally being re-altered right here, right now. And his work and Jenny's work and all this stuff is just really pointing towards this event that's happening. And it's not going to happen. I really have to iterate this. It's not going to happen suddenly on December 21st, 2012. It's happening right here, right now, and it's been happening since around 1992. And if you talk to people who are in this work, they almost all have some kind of story about how there was like the accelerator got hit to the floor around 1991, 1992, 1993. And it's true. And it was the same with me. And it was the same with Greg and a lot of other people. Lives shifted in the last 20 years, the last kin of the Mayan calendar. And now
lives will continue to shift when we get back after this break. This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We'll be right back.
We've been following an eerie story lately about a yacht found off the Australian coast with its entire crew disappeared. The engine was still running. A laptop computer was charging. The table was set for dinner, but the people were gone, eerily reminiscent of the Frederick Valentich case from 1978 off the Tasmanian coast, and also of another case, a May Day that was signaled in the Bermuda Triangle that we have actually got a copy of in the unknowncountry.com subscriber section. Listen to this old promo and think you could listen to this right now and so much more in our subscriber section. Subscribe to unknowncountry.com today. This is part of an actual Mayday transmission from a plane that disappeared in the Bermuda Triangle and was never seen again. UnknownCountry.com subscribers are getting to listen to the whole thing, plus G and Case are discussing this disappearance and the way it relates to the Frank Valentich disappearance of 2 years before off the coast of Australia. This is phenomenal stuff. You've got to listen to this. 13 cents a day makes you a subscriber to UnknownCountry.com. Click on that subscribe tab today. And to find this remarkable interview with Gian Kesar in our huge subscriber section, go to the Special Interviews Archive and search on the term Gian, G-I-A-N. You'll find it's still there along with so many others, they're almost impossible to count. It really is fabulously interesting, fabulously interesting.
This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We're continuing with Jay Widener. Jay, in the DVD 2012, The Odyssey, Moira Timms notes, "We are now in the white water of history, and each one of us will have this experience. It's a sublime initiation. How many of us, the best and the worst of us, how many of us wanted the best and the worst of the age has to offer? This is it." Jay, the initiation you described that we're all in the midst of has been described in your DVD as a transition time when Homo sapien becomes Homo luminous. Let's talk about that for a moment.
Well, that's one of my favorite subjects, and I think it's one of your favorite subjects. And what it really means is that the substructure of the DNA is changing. Very similar to the work I just described with Hans Jenny, the galaxy is directing a change in the way that the substructure of the DNA performs. And as Jeremy Narby shows us in his book, The Cosmic Serpent, inside every single DNA is a photon. A photon is, of course, light. And as we alter and align with the center of the galaxy, we're aligning with an invisible light. I don't know how else to describe it. It's an invisible light that pierces into our very center of our being and changes the structure of ourselves. In alchemy, in Falconelli's book, Mystery of the Cathedrals, he tells us that, you know, you have to perform your alchemical experiments in the sign of Aries. And I wondered for years why that had to be. And then I realized that Aries in Europe, where Falconelli lives, in Aries is right when the center of the galaxy finally peaks over the edge of the horizon and then begins to dominate the spring and summer sky in the northern hemisphere. And I realized that that's when the black light of Isis, the mother goddess, reappears. And you perform your experiments at night, and you perform them underneath this black photon that we can't see that's coming from the center of the galaxy. And that is what is transforming us and transmuting us even as we speak. It's making us brighter. It's making us more aware. And I think it's changing, at least if Greg and Moira are right, it's changing us, our bodies. It's making us, it's changing our immune systems. And it's altering us. And this is really, in a way, the secret of alchemy, because alchemy is about how to gather up this dark light and to use it to transmute elements. It's the negredo. It's the black matter. It's the dark stone that exists. And what's happening right now is this: as the ship of our solar system turns and lines up with this beam or with this flow or stream from the center of the galaxy, we are being initiated into a new species, I believe. And if we're not, then we're probably in a lot of trouble. So it's like this is our choice as human beings. Do we go down the road of darkness, or do we choose enlightenment and choose to accept what is happening to us?
Alberto Velado, another person who makes an appearance in the DVD, says that the Inca believed that the doorways between the worlds are opening, that holes in time that we can step through and beyond, where we can explore our latent human capabilities, are opening before us, and that we can craft new physical bodies that age differently, that heal differently, and that die differently. Jay, what I'm wondering, and this is something that I study quite a bit about, is this confluence of technologies that's happening right now in Silicon Valley, where genetic technology, where nanotechnology, computer technology, and neuroscience are all converging into one science, where what in the past, genes, bits, neurons, and atoms were separate. Now they're all going to be one, genes, bits, neurons, and atoms. And where all of this technology is being directed is into our human body. How comfortable are you with this idea that this transformation or transition into Homo luminous might in fact be affected through technology, that we, as we presently exist, we are essentially offline beings, but as this transition gains momentum, we more and more will become online beings? Where are we going with all of this?
That to me is just the most important question of all. One of my favorite people is the filmmaker Stanley Kubrick, and he was also obsessed with this idea that there's going to be some combination of human and machine that's going to create the Star Child, say, at the end of 2001. And my own personal feeling is that I think that the technology is profane. I think that it serves a purpose, and I think that the purpose of it is to show us how to be. That when we can concretize these things into material objects, then we can begin to understand how to transmute ourselves in a spiritual manner or in an etheric manner. For instance, the internet is not really a global telepathic event or situation, but what it does is it shows us that the guy in Argentina that you emailed, or the guy in New Guinea that you had a conversation with a couple weeks ago, or the guy in Russia who's interested in your book, that, you know, we're all pretty much the same. We all have the same fears and the same desires and the same wants. And what that does is that facilitates this global telepathic mind that's emerging. So what technology is it's cutting a path through the jungle that then we can walk freely down. And I think that's what it's doing. It's showing us a way, and it absolutely has to occur before we can make the final leap. And this is, of course, in 2001 Space Odyssey, what HAL is. In order for the astronaut to transmute into the Star Child, it was necessary to go through HAL, to have the computer do the things that it did in order to get him out there alone. So HAL, as HAL gains consciousness in 2001, he is in a way facilitating the transmutation of the species, even if HAL doesn't know that he's doing it. And this is a great metaphor, I think, for what technology is doing. I'm not afraid of technology, but I can see where technology in the wrong hands could become very dangerous. And I think that what we're going to have to do is accept the gifts of technology and find a way to reject the hazards and the toxicity that technology also gives us. And in the end, I think that's where this is all headed. And by the way, I'm going to forget his name now, Kurzweil. I don't know if you're familiar with his book.
Ray Kurzweil, yeah, author of Singularity.
The Singularity is Near. Okay, so he is addressing all of these subjects in this kind of technocratic way that borders on alchemy. And if you haven't read that book, I highly recommend it. Not because I agree with his conclusions necessarily, but because it's incredibly fascinating to watch his mind work towards an ultimate spiritual solution to these technologies that are emerging. And so I think that, these things are incredibly important, and they're happening right now, and it's no accident that they're happening right now, and they all have some kind of meaning to the situation that's emerging here at the end of time.
We are approaching a point, says Jeff Stray, when a mass kundalini experience is going to be triggered and Shakti will rise up the spine to meet Shiva coming down from above. So you have something called the spiritual wedding. Sharon Rose tells us that the upper world and the lower world embracing in the union of male and female energies, Shiva and Shakti, the sacred marriage, is perhaps the inner message of 2012. And also, says Greg Braden, it is the little acts that will determine 2012 and what is to come beyond that. After the break, we're going to continue with Jay Widener and find out more about current synchronicities and the Maya in 2012. This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We'll be right back.
My mind was racing. visions of galactic beams and planetary gestation were overwhelming me. Was it true? Had the Mayans created some kind of way to be able to tell us, the people of the future, where we were headed and what lay in store for us? Was time something tangible that could be mapped in some way? Everywhere I go, I talk to people who sense that something is going on, but we aren't quite sure what it is. The future world is still blurry and out of focus for most of us, but we all feel it. Something unusual is happening in our world. Something odd is happening to us. And like a shadow on the wall, we are not sure if it's real or an illusion.
And yet, with scientists telling us the next solar max happening in 2011 and 2012 is going to be the greatest in recorded history, and with all of the other changes are taking place, we have to believe that maybe there is something real, or at least something to be learned here. Get Jay Widener's wonderful new DVD, 2012, The Odyssey. Get it from the unknowncountry.com store.
This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We're continuing with Jay Widener. Jay, Mel Gibson's new movie, Apocalypto, has its share of critics. There are more than a million Maya in Mexico, and more than 100,000 of them are monolingual Yucatanian speakers. Yet, Gibson chose not one Maya for a featured role, and in so doing, he's made a film that some say reinforces the prejudice against the Maya. And according to other critics, they say the Maya are just now learning about their 2012 prophecies from the white man. What are your thoughts on these kinds of, this kind of antagonism, in a sense, towards this whole idea of 2012? Are we going to have the media, on the one hand, throwing rocks at everybody who's a quote-unquote believer in this whole idea of transcendence? Or is there going to be coming upon us a single verifiable event, sort of like the second sun in 2010, that sort of brings everybody together in a flash?
Well, that really is a great question. Back in the old New Age days, we kept hearing people telling us that the Mayans had disappeared from Mexico, mm-hmm. all in mass, like 800 years ago. And, you know, this
right.
is just as silly as it gets because, you know, if you've ever been down to the area, all you do is meet Mayan people. And mm-hmm. They didn't disappear or go away. They just abandoned their cities. Now, I haven't seen Apocalypto, but I do want to see it. But this is incredible because there's this whole movement that people in the United States don't realize that it's coming out of Mexico. It's called the Reconquista. And mm-hmm. if you get on websites and read about this Reconquista, which means the reconquest, you find that the Mexicans are really moving back into the Southwest United States and trying to take back the land they believe is theirs. That the
Excellent,
white
right.
Okay, so what's really amazing about this whole thing, though, is that these people are not using their real names. They're all using Mayan names.
Oh,
they're
wow.
all using Mayan calendar dates, not Gregorian calendar dates, in their emails and in their websites. And I don't know what to make of this, except that, you know, wow, you know, it's almost as if there is a resurgence of the Mayan mythos right now. And it appears that it's, you know, beginning to enter into the United States. And, I don't have any opinion one way or the other on any of this. I just find it fascinating. And so this, you know, this brings to mind this kind of is what will happen in 2012, and are we going to be chastised by the media for some kind of crazy New Age belief? Well, Terrence McKenna once told me that even the most hard-cold rationalist has got to have his palms sweating about now, because there is almost no way that anyone can say that this civilization, this world, can go on the way it is, with the deforestation and the depleting of the soils and the environmental damage and the global climate change that's occurring. And so I think that, yeah, we're going to be attacked by certain people, just like they're attacking Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth. But in the end, I think one step at a time, we're beginning to chip away at these people, and they're beginning to understand that there is something going on. There is a fundamental shift happening, and there's almost no way to stop it. And I think the Mayans have a role. I think they actually have a big role, and it's just going to start emerging now. I hope that, you know, the Mayans don't think that they're getting all their information from the white people, because it was the Mayans who left this stuff behind for us to find. And, you know, so Jenkins could not have figured out what he knew without the Mayans, and we owe the Mayans a great, great, great deal of debt for what they've done for us in this time period.
Jay, one of the messages that rings through 2012, The Odyssey, to me is this whole idea of not just kindness, as you mentioned with Greg Braden, but also this idea, in a sense, of integrity, of, in fact, sort of transparency. And as I was preparing to talk with you today, a glaring, almost, let's just call it an obscene fact was published on the World News Services. And the fact is that almost 90% of the world's wealth is held in North America, Europe, and in high-income Asian and Pacific countries such as Japan and Australia. They liken this situation to that where in a group of 10 people, one person has $99 while the remaining nine share $1. And it seems to me that as this overmind, as you describe it, begins to peer down upon us, that glaring facts such as that are going to come to our attention, and we're going to have to reconcile situations like that. I used to quote the UN number that said half the world's population doesn't have access to a toilet and is 2.5 days' walk from the nearest telephone. And that situation has been changing slightly by the introduction of cell phones to some of these regions. But aren't issues such as this the place that this whole idea of a transformation in 2012 must begin?
Well, yeah, everything has to begin on a political level, that's for sure. And I don't know how we're going to deal with that. It is a serious, serious problem, and one that is not being addressed enough. And it's going to become a big issue. It really is already. The newly elected senator from Virginia, James Webb, has really taken this up. And a lot of people are not very happy about it. And, the redistribution of wealth is going to be probably one of the biggest issues that is coming to the front here. And I think that, you know, the war in Iraq and what's happening in Iran and all of this, it appears that 1% that owns everything is directing all of these things in a kind of mad, insane attack to grab the last of the resources before they disappear. And we really, really have to come to grips with this whole thing. And it starts on a political level, and it starts here in America first, which is why America is the most important country on Earth right now during this transition, because we are the ones who have to change the most. We're the ones that are causing the global climate change. We are the ones who are fomenting wars, and we are the ones who are grabbing the resources. And we're going to have to come to grips with the whole corporate culture. I think one thing that could really, really change things quickly is if we could make the heads of corporations personally responsible for the actions of their companies. I think that one single act could probably alter the landscape quickly, because if a CEO knew that he was going to go to jail for dumping mercury or for causing landslides in his clear cutting, then I think that you would see things quickly alter. But until that happens, I don't know what we're going to be able to do about it, short of some kind of revolution, which I definitely do not support. So it's a great question. It's really going to end up being the most vexing of all the questions that come before us, I think.
Jay, let's talk about Earth changes for a moment, too. In the DVD, Greg Braden talks about how Earth is going through a magnetic reversal that happens periodically and has happened over the past 4 million years or so, and that we are now at the lowest point we've seen in 2,000 years in terms of our magnetic field. And what that means is the shield or buffer of the magnetic field that protects the Earth is at its lowest point in 2,000 years, and this makes us very susceptible to solar influences such as unprecedented solar flares. And because of this, because they're not there, it's allowing for the melting of the poles. Well, recently unknowncountry.com reported that scientists have determined that the Ross Ice Shelf in the Antarctic could collapse without warning in a matter of days, causing a disastrous worldwide sea level rise of 16 feet. What I wanted to ask you about, Jay, is this is just yet another alarming example of what's happening, and that we could literally, in a single catastrophe, essentially just see every coastal city in the world destroyed virtually overnight. Do you still, or where are you at now on this whole business that Folconelli introduced about the refuge of the apocalypse, of the Northern Hemisphere being tried by fire somehow, and that there may be a place of where the elite, the children of Elijah, or Elias, as he described, can be saved during such a cataclysm?
Well, I actually, every day I believe it more. When I interviewed Jose Arguelles in the film, we gave him a copy of the Henday book, and he went home and he read it, and he's moving to New Zealand now. And so, you know, a lot of people are taking this to heart, and they're moving to the Southern Hemisphere, have many, many friends who are on their way there. And, I can't help but believe that if there was some kind of global superstorm or some kind of event that would happen via climate change, that the Northern Hemisphere, since most of the land is in the Northern Hemisphere, would be the hemisphere that's the most affected. So do I think that Peru and the Southern Hemisphere is the place of refuge? Yeah, I do. I think Folconelli just gets righter and righter every day. And he, predicted in 1950s that there was about to be a big heat up of the Earth, and that's happening. It's happening everywhere. Where I live in the Northwest, we're getting hit by the most incredible storms, tropical storms, snowstorms, all sorts of things are happening that are unprecedented, and not to mention the hottest summer that we've ever had. And so, these things are happening, and anyone who doesn't think that they're happening is just not paying attention. And do I think that the Ross Ice Shelf is going to break? Yeah, I think there's going to be an incredible melting, and then possibly an ice age of some kind. In climatology, we know that ice ages are preceded by a huge heat up, and I don't know. We may be in the middle of the heat up that's happening before the next ice age, and if that happens, you can bet the Northern Hemisphere is not going to be a very pleasant place to live.
And you hear these nasty rumors about the Bush family buying property in Paraguay, and you just wonder, wow, is this really true?
I think it is true, I think that that a lot of people are. The thing is that the elite are not the rich. They're, as you say, they're a spiritual elite. And that's who we have to get to understand. When Folconelli says the elite, he's not talking about a bunch of Republicans. He's talking about people who are of our ilk. And those are the ones who are going to escape and are going to be the people who populate the earth in the next age. And so I feel I love America, and I love the Northern Hemisphere, and I love our culture and everything. But, I'm beginning to feel also a little bit uncomfortable. I'm looking out at the ocean right now, and I really don't want it to rise too much more, to be honest with you.
Right.
And these things are true, and they're happening. And I don't think that anyone can deny it. If you've ever read Whitley Strieber's book, The Global Superstorm, I think that the evidence there is pretty overwhelming that this is what's going on. And what's causing it? I don't know what's causing it. Maybe it's us. Maybe it's the sun. Maybe it's a combination of everything.
J. Teilhard de Chardin said, during times of universal distress, archetypes of wholeness are released from the collective deep mind in order to reconstitute the fragments into wholeness. Jay, I want to thank you very much for connecting us to the Overmind of 2012 today and for sharing this incredible DVD, 2012, The Odyssey. I look forward to talking with you again soon, my friend. This is William Henry. Next up, Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda Moulton Howe, unique in this world, a science reporter who dares to approach our environment with an open mind. She's willing to look at the deepest of mysteries, and her website, earthfiles.com, is the very finest website of its kind in the world. Do not let your day pass without going to earthfiles.com. Linda Moulton Howe, the best there is. This week, Linda Moulton Howe reports on the very latest findings on colony collapse disorder, interviewing a United States Department of Agriculture scientist who is working frantically to understand this extremely serious bee disease. We cannot live without the bees, and they are dying at a very rapid rate of speed worldwide. It's a problem that we absolutely must solve within the next 18 to 24 months, or this species will be in the worst trouble it has ever been in its history. Here she is from Albuquerque, earthfiles.com's Linda Moulton Howe, and don't miss a single day of earthfiles.com. It's more important than ever every day as the rest of the journalistic community abandons real science reporting. Linda Moulton Howe keeps on keeping on. Earthfiles.com. Here she is, Linda Moulton Howe.
Thank you, Whitley. In the last week of April 2007, there were two important meetings concerning the disappearing honeybee phenomenon that scientists call colony collapse disorder, or CCD. One was a meeting of scientists and beekeepers at the USDA laboratory in Beltsville, Maryland. The other was a House Subcommittee Horticulture meeting organized by Florida Congressman Al C. Hastings. His state's beekeepers have been badly hurt by honeybee disappearances. The Apiary Inspectors of America now estimate that at least a quarter of the 2.4 million bee colonies in the United States have disappeared since the fall of 2006. Some honeybee colonies have entirely disappeared in only 2 days. But so far, no one knows why. Scientists, beekeepers, and government investigators learned that China is now reporting bee disappearances along with Brazil and Guatemala. That means the colony collapse disorder now extends into the southern hemisphere as well. And on April 26, Taiwan was added to the list. Reuters reported that over the past 2 months, farmers in three Taiwan regions have notified authorities that the bees are gone. Taiwan has been unusually warm, and entomologists at National Taiwan University wonder if global warming, combined with nicotine-based pesticides that affect bee memory, could be the cause there. In North America, CCD has been reported by 27 American states now and two provinces in Canada, Saskatchewan and Ontario. In Europe so far, nine nations are reporting deserted honeybee hives, and those are Spain, Poland, Greece, Croatia, Switzerland, Italy, Portugal, Germany, and England. So far, nothing in France, which banned the nicotine-based pesticides, and people wonder if there is a connection. Researchers have found multiple viruses and some fungi in the affected bees that are also found in humans suffering from AIDS or cancer, suggesting that whatever is happening, the immune systems of the bees are severely weakened. Professor Diana Cox Foster, a Pennsylvania State University entomologist, told me recently that she has never seen five viruses combined with several fungi all in a bee gut at the same time. And she said, this is extremely unusual. A USDA laboratory in North Carolina is now studying bee bodies to test for 117 chemicals, the one pesticide that is at the top of all scientific lists of possible culprits in colony collapse disorder are the relatively new nicotine-based pesticides such as imidacloprid. Ironically, when these neonicotinoids came on the market, manufacturers thought the nicotine-based chemicals would be less toxic in the environment. But no one had done detailed studies about the effects of nicotine-based pesticides on honeybees and other pollinators until recently. It's been confirmed that the nicotine-based toxins can impair bee memory, which might explain why the beehives are deserted. Perhaps the bees are becoming disoriented and unable to fly back home. One of the contributors to the USDA meeting in Maryland on April 23rd to 24th was Jerry Hayes, chief of the apiary section in the Florida Department of Agriculture in Gainesville. This week, I asked him what was discussed at the USDA meeting about the fact that the colony collapse disorder is not going away this spring, but seems to be expanding.
Well, at the meeting I was able to attend in Beltsville, Maryland, at USDA for the colony collapse working group that was assembled, there was discussion of how we can partner with Europeans and our colleagues in South America. And also we had word yesterday that China is experiencing this thing. So this is a global issue and a global problem. So what does that mean from a global standpoint? Is this a new pathogen? Is it a new pest? Is it chemicals that we use in developing countries and in production agriculture? And so it opens up a whole new Pandora's box of things.
And what about the issue of cell phone towers and the spread of microwaves, which at least the German researcher, it made headlines in the last 2 weeks from Europe. Could you comment on what you know about that so far?
Well, this certainly was a topic on the periphery in the working group meetings, but none of it was taken too seriously, as apparently if you read the whole paper, there was no statistical evidence that cell phone or microwaves or magnetic radiation was involved. And the way I understood it was that a group in Germany that is anti-technology kind of released this with a spin to get the media's attention, since the media already given so much attention to the colony collapse disorder. So it wasn't taken very seriously by any of my colleagues.
Could you comment on what you think about the work of Bee Alert and Jerry Bromenschenk with a study on microwaves and bees?
Yes, and Jerry Bromenschenk, Dr. Jerry Bromenschenk from the University of Montana, was at the CCD working group meeting earlier this week, and he actually offered that they had already looked at that several years ago by actually putting cell phones and putting big electromagnetic fields around colonies just to see if this was going to be a problem or if it was an issue that needed to look at more closely, and they were not able to find any causative problems from the. It seems to be that all bees at some level are being affected by whatever the causative organism or toxin is of CCD.
When we talked in early March, there was a lot of questions about the neonicotinoids, specifically imidacloprid and other nicotine-based pesticides that have really only been being used in a kind of universal way in the last 4 years. Has there been any progress in trying to understand if the fact that the neonicotinoids can interfere with the ability to remember, does anybody right now have any kind of hard science data that might say that the neonicotinoids might be at the root of all this?
There certainly is existing data out there, and there was a representative from Bayer who makes some of the neonicotinoids, and I believe Syngenta also was on the conference call line at our meeting, and they were all very helpful. They would certainly like to get to the bottom of this also. So there is data out there. These neonicotinoids stay in the soil for a very long time. In fact, data shows that in temperate climates where they have winter, it's not unusual for those chemicals to stay active in the soil for a year, 18 months, longer.
And if more keeps being added, then it would be almost impossible for humans to know exactly what the exposure of the pollinators would be to nicotine-based pesticides that keep being built up.
Exactly right, and there's an interesting study of neonicotinoids and imidacloprid, I think, on potatoes to control the Colorado potato beetle. And so they applied it, and it was systemic, and it controlled the Colorado potato beetle. So the next year, they planted potatoes. They didn't treat the crop, and they found that the potatoes grown on that same soil still killed the Colorado potato beetle.
And that means that it was strong enough in the soil without even another application.
Yeah, and so what happens if you do follow the label directions and make the application every year for 5 years? How long does it stay in the soil, and what does it mean for crops that are deep-rooted? What does it mean for crops that are shallow-rooted? I have a lot of questions here, Linda.
And I think it was Dr. Cox Foster pointed out to me that the amount of the nicotine-based pesticide that could impact the bees may be much lower than anybody has been measuring. And the question of accumulation over time is not understood, and it may be that that is the big culprit.
Yeah, it could be.
And if it is, how do we put the genie back in the bottle? The neonicotinoids are so widespread out there.
Yeah, and that's the hard thing about it. The neonicotinoids replace OPs, organophosphates, which are very persistent and toxic chemicals. So when they found this new chemistry, it was thought good. And there's other new chemistry coming out there, I think. The neonicotinoids, or at least imidacloprid, has come off patent. And so it will be actually used even more as the price goes down. But we certainly don't want to pit one industry against another unless there's a replacement. We don't want beekeepers pointing the fingers at growers for using things to preserve their industry, nor do we want the industry pointing their fingers at beekeepers saying, you've made me lose my business because I can't use these chemicals anymore. So it's a tightrope, Linda.
But what if it comes down to survival versus money?
I vote for survival, but I'm only one voice in the wilderness here.
Well, yes, I'm assuming that humans and animals would want to survive, and if it becomes scientifically proved that the neonicotinoids and perhaps other pesticides such as fungicides all layered together are killing out the pollinators of the world, aren't we going to have to put a stop to the use of pesticides and fungicides at some level?
Yes.
And how will that happen? That's what I mean about putting the genie back in the bottle.
Well, coming from a government bureaucratic environment here, the proper course of action, of course, would be get the scientific data that prove this, submit the scientific data to the EPA, and then they would have no choice but to pull the product.
In terms of science, who is studying now the nicotine-based pesticides the most in relationship to the pollinators?
At the working group meeting, pesticides were on the list of things we wanted to look at, but until the money is let to USDA to, in turn, distribute, there have been no collaborators designated or identified that will look at that particular issue at this time.
So there is no science focused on the nicotine-based pesticides in relationship to pollinators because there is no additional funding so far?
Yes, ma'am.
Is this what the House Congressional Subcommittee now is addressing in terms of having proposals that they can fund specifically to try to get a handle on what is happening to pollinators in North America?
Yes, exactly. Because of the media attention and the reality of the loss of this key niche in agriculture, our legislators in Washington are keenly aware that help and resources needs to be devoted to this industry.
Now, some people have suggested that maybe it has something to do with solar radiation or magnetic changes in our pole. Is there anybody specifically looking at magnetic field changes on the Earth that might affect the bees?
No. The feeling with the electromagnetic fields was certainly should be looked at and certainly should be a component, but we all have a hard time thinking that on a U.S., North American, global basis, that all the bees would be affected in the same way at the same time because there are blanks and gaps in all this electromagnetic thing. So it seems to us that it's probably more likely toxin, whether it's man-made, comes from a bacterium or a fungus or what have you, rather than just one thing we can blame it on. This electromagnetic field could be a part of the problem, but we don't think it's a primary part.
And what would be at the top of your priority list in terms of possible causes?
Well, you know, we certainly have to look at environmental toxins and agricultural toxins, and then, of course, we have to look at miticides that beekeepers have to use now to control parasitic mites that were introduced several years ago from Asia that suck the blood of honeybees, and then we have to look at, of course, the carriers of these materials, and then we have to look at nutrition issues and fungicides. Honeybees can forge in about a 2-2.5 mile radius of the colony efficiently, so they can bring back a lot of things from the environment, from industry, from waste products, and they can also be exposed to many, many things in an agricultural setting. And beeswax is a chemical sponge, so everything that the bee brings back in many times is sucked up and stored and represented in the beeswax. It'd be almost like a hair sample from you and I. Take a hair sample, and scientists can tell pretty much what we've been exposed to over several weeks or several months. So it's the same thing with beeswax. And so what happens when beeswax absorbs many, many different things? What's the synergism in the beeswax? And then what does that mean when honeybees are exposed to these kind of things 24/7, 365? Data that was shared at the meeting indicated that there were a lot of things in there, not only primary things, but metabolites. As these chemicals break down, sometimes metabolites are more toxic than the actual ingredient. And so, one, you have to identify it, and then you have to say, well, what does this mean in the context of everything else that the honeybee is being exposed to? So it's going to take some analysis, but analysis with urgency, because we can't have beekeepers losing 30, 40, 50, 60% of colonies next year as well, because it's just going to get worse. We need to come up with some answers and some recommendations pretty quickly.
Well, is it fair to say that right now, as Dr. Cox Foster told me a week or two ago, there really are not enough pollinators now to go around in the United States?
It's getting pretty slim. We've had some tight situations here in Florida with growers being able to access pollinators. With the almond crop and almond acreage growing so much in California and going to dominate the need for pollinators here in the next few years, the question is, if every beehive in the country goes to almonds, what does that mean for the states that they left from? What does it mean for watermelons and blueberries and cranberries and cucumbers and apples? And I can go on and on and on. The health and vitality of the beekeeping industry really needs to be fostered.
And how can it be if the bees keep disappearing?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Exactly. And that's why we have to work as hard as we can and intelligently as we can and get as many resources as we can so that we can answer those questions. We certainly don't want a shortage of fruits and nuts and berries to be the driving force behind this.
Well, this is the seventh month since October of 2006 when Dave Hackenberg first went to Penn State and the University of Pennsylvania, saying that he had lost somewhere between 40 and 70% of his hives, and yet there are no answers. That seems to me at this point, after 7 months with more than 100 scientists trying to figure out what's going on, that it's remarkable in and of itself that there are no answers.
Yeah, and it's pretty spooky. We have a tendency in the research community to have healthy egos, meaning that if you give me a problem and I have the appropriate equipment and we can partner with other colleagues, that anything can be solved. And after 7 months, not being able to solve something that would on the surface seem to be pretty easy to solve is confusing and frustrating, and of course is bringing some level of anxiety to all of us to even work harder.
And the fact that it is spreading both in the northern hemisphere and now into the southern hemisphere, when you all were in the colony collapse disorder meeting, what were the comments about the fact that this is spreading in both hemispheres now?
Concern, if I could use the word fear, because we in this group know how important honeybees are to the production of the foods we eat. And we haven't even talked about the fruits, nuts, and berries that honeybees pollinate that feed wildlife. And with it spreading like this, and not having answers after 7 months, yeah, there is a lot of anxious feelings out there.
When you think about this huge mystery that the bees are disappearing globally, intuitively, do you have some kind of a gut instinct about what could be going on?
Yeah, I think personally we have a new or more robust pathogen that combined with chemical toxins that are causing the honeybee's fragile immune system to be weakened further is taking hold, because all reports are from developed or developing nations that use chemicals quite widely, and with global trade and movement of organisms throughout the world very quickly, that makes sense to me.
But doesn't it seem strange that scientists in Europe, Canada, the United States, and now the ones that would be looking in Brazil and China, that no one has come up with a common denominator in all of these regions?
Yeah, I think that because there is no one common denominator, I think there's probably three or four common denominators, and they're all intersecting at one time, and the bees are holding up their little legs and saying, I give up.
But what would have happened at the end of 2006 going into the fall that changed from the previous years?
Yeah, excellent question. Those are all science-based questions, and I nor anyone else knows what that could be that would be on a global basis.
I guess it's like pray that there can be an answer here soon. And if not, what do you guys do?
It's not what do you guys do, it's what do we do. We're all on this spaceship Earth together. The question about all of our other brothers and sisters in the world, and how do we approach this, and then how do we fix or solve a problem, and also how do we share resources and not be quite so selfish in doing that. You know, I'm not quite sure that we as humans have learned how to do that well enough yet.
On April 26, researchers at the University of California, San Francisco, reported their lab has confirmed the presence of the single-celled fungus called Nosema in affected hives around the United States, as well as in hives where some bees have survived. Nosema has also been found in collapsing hives in Spain. But is this fungi the answer to colony collapse disorder, or only another hypothesis on the growing list that more than 100 American scientists want to study in an effort to solve this honeybee mystery and crisis? But those scientists are hampered even now by lack of research funding as honey the colony collapse disorder spreads in the world. And Whitley, when you realize how much money this Congress and this government is putting out each year for war, to realize that our very food and our survival ultimately, if this isn't solved, could be affected by lack of research funding for scientists to study this crisis.
Well, you know, Linda, it's absolutely terrifying. And one thing, at least there has been a hearing, I believe, about it. And so some congresspeople are aware of the danger that's involved here. And it's an extraordinary danger. It's a profound danger. I think that it's probably as dangerous as anything that has ever happened environmentally. Because if we don't stop this, and in 2 years at the rate that they are going, most of the bees on the planet will be dead. And reestablishing, even if by then we do figure out what happened, reestablishing those colonies in the context of the social collapse that will be occurring worldwide at that time because of this, not to mention the interruptions in the food chain environmentally across the board, you're talking about a mass extinction event, and one that we would not, it's about to spiral out of control. However, I will say, unfortunately, he did make a comment about if it turns out that this is caused by something like a pesticide, then the corporate world and ultimately also the politicians will definitely opt in favor of the annihilation of this species rather than the money. Will opt for the money over the annihilation of the species. There's no question in my mind about it. we are institutionally dysfunctional as a species. That's why this happens, and why there could even be a question raised about whether or not corporations would resist solving this problem if it turns out to be based pesticide-based or cell phone-based or however they people think it might be. If that's true, the problem will not be solved. The corporate lobbyists will prevent that until they themselves are starving.
Well, I thought it was refreshing the fast and strong way he said, if the science finds that the neonicotinoids or other pesticides are the strongest link to the disappearance of the honeybees, then, he said, EPA would have to recall those pesticides.
EPA will drag its feet. I mean, this is the Bush administration's EPA. It's not going to recall this unless it absolutely has to. And it won't have to. Presumably, there'll be any number of different reasons. I mean, he said that very forcefully. I know it, but I just don't believe it. I don't believe it for a minute.
Well, it certainly would challenge EPA to live up to its name, Environmental Protection Agency. And, Whitley, I am especially curious about what the genome study at the University of Illinois and USDA Beltsville is going to be able to provide in about, they think, another 4 months. It will be a news update that I will do on Dreamland and Earth Files, because if they find that there is a turn-on and turn-off of the genes in the genome, the honeybee genome, that points directly at toxins, that will be the hardest proof.
It will be indeed, and then the question becomes, how do we find the toxins, and where are they in the environment? Because they could be, he was referring, for example, to toxins that may have been inculcated into the soil, that it might take, even once they're recalled, it might take years to get them out of the environment, during which time we're going to experience the full disaster with the honeybees, because this thing is happening too fast. It's spreading like wildfire. Just today, it turns out that the mites have appeared in Hawaii, and the mites apparently are a secondary effect. They're always with the bees. They've been there for millions of years. But it's like so many of these disorders that have been afflicting various plants. When the immune system is suppressed, the disease becomes very aggressive. That's what's then. So the mites are not. It's not that the mites are spreading. It is that something else is weakening the bees and causing the bees to become susceptible to the mites. And so fast. I mean, how could this have gotten to Hawaii as an airborne disease vector? How could it be spreading around the world so fast? The reason is that it's not an airborne disease vector at all. It is something in the environment, almost certainly something we are putting there that's new.
Right.
I have a feeling that the nicotine-based pesticides are going to be the culprits. And if that's true, I think we're in real trouble. Because I believe it. Who puts those out? Is it Bayer or Monsanto, one of those companies?
It's a combination of several companies. And I, you know that I have been focusing on the neonicotinoids really since I began investigating this in February. Because when you realize that they impair the bees' ability to have memory. And today, when Jerry Hayes confirms that there have already been tests on the neonicotinoid pesticide staying in the soil on that potato research.
That was absolutely terrifying.
Exactly. And if the nicotine-based pesticides have the ability to kill beetles 2 years without any reapplication, then it means that there is not a human on this planet who knows now how much toxicity is in the soil that the bees are exposed to, and already it is very clear that a very, very low level of the neonicotinoids already impair the bees. And this is now like a whole new realm of science that is opening up, because the bees are disappearing.
And the corporations that were responsible for this, in this case, will be happy because First, they probably won't have to stop distributing this product, even if it's proved that it's destroying the bees. And second, if they do destroy the bees and we all starve to death, then it doesn't matter because they still can't be blamed. There'll be nobody left alive to blame them.
It's absolutely, at one level, Voltairean satire, isn't it, on the way humans have lived.
It's horrifying because that's exactly what will happen. As I say, this species is institutionally dysfunctional, and one of the most dysfunctional institutions we possess is the corporation and its need for perpetual growth that has fueled so much abuse of both human beings, animals, plants, and the environment in general because of the continuous need for corporations that's culturally induced, for corporations to always increase their bottom line. We have a situation where we're basically ruining our world and ruining it very fast. And this thing, I think this thing is going to come back and bite us, and unfortunately it's not going to sting us like a bee.
Yes, I think it's really, truly the kind of a tipping point. We have a lot of tipping points on the earth right now, but this one is in our face.
It is really in our face, Linda. Linda, what are you working on now? You always have such fascinating things that are boiling on the back burner. And we've got about 3 more minutes, so.
I am heading out tomorrow for a meeting in Ohio near the Serpent Mound and those beautiful mounds where the crop formations have been focused in the United States over the years. And I'm meeting with Jeff Wilson and other people in the Independent Crop Circle Research Association. And we're going to bring together some of our respective research, and I'm going to share with them the hot-off-the-presses research by biophysicist W.C. Levengood on the America First 2007 formation that was down in Phoenix in the Chandler suburb. And it turned out the plants were what are called sorghum bicolor, and the amount of biophysical and biochemical changes that W.C. Levengood was able to confirm in these plants put down in a very odd pattern of standing vertically and down plants, that we have seen this now for at least 15 years, where the plants are put down, but they are put down as if something pulsed or waved the crops for 600, 1,000 feet. It is an amazing phenomenon that biophysicist W.C. Levengood would say was the result of a spinning plasma vortex, source unknown, that has the ability to interact with crops, and his physics is the best in the world, is biophysics. And right now we're beginning to find more and more ways to separate out wind damage, possible when there are violators of crops that are human, versus this truly mysterious phenomenon of some kind of plasma that has the ability to put down either beautiful geometry or these strange randomly down patterns that we see especially in the United States. And something must be doing this for a reason. And this will be part of what I'm talking about with these people at the magnificent ancient Serpent Mound in Ohio this weekend.
Well, that sounds wonderfully exciting, Linda. And all I can say is this. What will you do when you look out across a field and see grays walking around in it with boards on their feet?
I just want to say, hey, give me a chance. Let me feel a telepathic download, upload. I want to know if I can communicate.
Next week on Dreamland, Om Seti. Who was Om Seti? Well, you'll find out one of the most extraordinary cases of reincarnation ever recorded. And maybe it was actually the most extraordinary case. And we will be talking for subscribers to a gentleman in Cairo who actually personally knew Om Seti, this remarkable individual, a distinguished Egyptian scientist, who became convinced after years of study and empirical proof that Om Seti could find buried ruins that could only have been known to an ancient Egyptian. It's a remarkable show.
This has been Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back next week with another journey to the extreme edge of controversy on Dreamland. Do not miss it.